Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've been hearing about the year of the woman in politics since the mid-1990s, but the numbers from the 2017 election cycle don't lie. Advocacy organizations report that women sought elective office in record numbers this year, and the number of women who voted this year once again exceeded the number of men. We're talking about women and other legally defined minorities in politics, the history, the patterns, and the future. Joining us by phone is director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, Debbie Walsh. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Also, Ohio State University political scientist Wendy Smooth. Professor Smooth teaches in the OSU Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department, which is hosting a two-day symposium this week on the growing diversity of the American electorate. For more information, check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. Wendy Smooth, welcome back.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be back.
Emily's List reported that more than 20,000 women sought elective office this election cycle. She should run. A nonpartisan organization reported that more than 15,000 female candidates contacted them. Wendy Smooth, what's the motivation here?
Women are on fire. We saw that immediately following the elections. A lot of this is geared up from the Women's March. Women united, women had conversations. It wasn't just showing up and, you know, having the fun hats on. Women were really ready to do business. And out of that, they followed through. Women are finding their voices. They are getting interested in topics that strike at the home front and are talking about the economy, are talking about discrimination. And as we're seeing through all of the sexual harassment cases, when women find their voices, they're ready to move to action. And I think this is what we've seen in terms of women connecting with these organizations that you named. And there's so many more that they're connecting with to find out how they can maximize their involvement and maximize their concerns.
You know, Debbie Walsh, it's interesting the way Wendy Smooth put that. When women find their voices, they're ready to move to action. You know, just during my 40-odd plus years in journalism, so many women that I've covered started out as advocates for something close to them. Maybe their kid had a learning disability. Maybe there was a problem on their, you know, with the garbage pickup on their street or whatever. They always have, you know, in my experience, been more motivated by particular issues.
You know, that's exactly what we found in the research that we've done when we talked to men and women who serve in state legislatures, and we asked them why they ran for office in the first place. We're really trying to get at what motivates people to run for office. And the men tell us that they're interested in what motivated them was a longtime interest in politics and a career in politics. And women tell us that it's a policy issue. And I think what it really boils down to is that men run to be somebody and women run to do something. And that's what gets them to run for office in the first place. And I think I totally agree with what Wendy was saying before about what has spurred this on. I think women are angry. They saw the election of Donald Trump. They are worried about issues that affect their families, their communities, their lives, and the planet. And they are looking for a way to have a voice. And they feel that now, more than ever, they cannot sit out on the sidelines. They cannot let somebody else do the politics part. They have to be the ones stepping up and thinking about talking about running for office themselves.
You know, it's interesting. There's a subtlety in how Donald Trump motivated. I mean, some are motivated by what they see as negative qualities in President Trump. Others are inspired that he could get elected at all without much of a resume in civic leadership. Right, Debbie Walsh? I mean, right? Wendy Smooth?
Absolutely. Yes. I think, you know, one of the things that we have heard so often is that women have to prove their qualifications when they're candidates. There's sort of an assumption of qualified for men who run, and women have to prove that. And I think that this past presidential election was such a reminder to women of that, this whole issue of the woman who shows up with the perfect resume, right, for the job, and then there's the man who shows up for that same job clearly lacking in the same kinds of qualifications, but somehow manages to get the job. And I think that was part of the frustration and the anger that we saw in response to that in addition to the host of policy issues. And I think in addition to, and I think we have to talk about this, the misogyny in that campaign, particularly at the end with the Access Hollywood tape.
The crotch-grabbing tape, right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women really felt that, oh, well, now this can't possibly happen, right? America can't elect somebody who can say this in public. And guess what? We can. So that added to, and that really fueled this fire that I think we're seeing.
You know, Debbie, I completely agree. And I have to say, after the election, I was actually worried that for women, the lesson would be no matter how hard you work, no matter the qualifications that you hold, you still have limitations. And I am so mm-hmm. refreshed to see
yes.
that yes. was not the actual outcome, that women actually began to see that outsiders can make it in, right?
Yes.
And that you can be innovative and creative and make your way. And at the same time, so on one front, we are definitely seeing women take that approach. And Debbie's very familiar with this research, and some of the colleagues who've worked with COP, her organization, have been looking at this question for quite some time, is that we still see the familiar patterns. In this last election cycle, we saw women geared up at the very local level. And we're still digging through the results across the nation mm-hmm. to see all of the various city councils and the school boards that women were elected to, the commissioner offices, which is very difficult data to get a hold of, but we're mining through that
yeah.
even as we speak. But we're seeing the very familiar patterns that women have always used in politics. They will start at the very local level and understand themselves as getting in on the ground floor, and they have to get experience at the local level. I'll run for the school board, and then I'll run for the city council, and then I'll run, and the list goes on mm-hmm. and on. And the trouble that we see with that approach is that if we take that approach, we've got some incredible stars who are serving at the very local level who really need to be in very high-profile leadership positions.
They're stuck.
Well, not necessarily stuck, but climbing
too slowly through the ranks.
Right, and needing to take step by step.
I actually think this election cycle, Wendy, and I'm happy to start to see a little of this, we're seeing a lot of first-time candidates running for those state legislative seats in mm-hmm. Virginia, New Jersey. And we're seeing it when we look at the women who are thinking about running in 2018, a really large proportion of the women who are saying now they want to run in 2018, we're like double, if not more than double, the number that we saw two cycles ago. But a lot of these are first-time candidates. So we may, all the research that we did for so many years that showed us that women needed to be asked to run, whereas mm-hmm. men would just wake up one morning and run. I think women aren't waiting around anymore to be asked. They're just running.
There's also the issue of running and failing, and that being not, that women tend to walk away after the first failure, men don't. Wendy Smooth?
Well, one of the ways that I see the kind of larger women in politics community attempting to counter that, and I think this also, Debbie, speaks to your point about the first-time candidates, is that the organizations that you talked about who are doing candidate trainings, part of the message, and COP is one of the organizations that has been very successful in doing candidate training, particularly in New Jersey, and we're seeing great results. So congratulations with that, too.
Again, it's the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University,
yes,
right?
New Jersey is exciting. But one of the things that we're hearing, one of the messages that comes through in those trainings is that you could fail the first time. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's OK to fail the first time, because out of that failure, what you gain is name recognition. And the next time you run, people are looking for, they see your name. They know, they recognize
right.
you. And that's an important and powerful tool for any candidate who's running.
Well, if you failed, what are voters thinking, Debbie Walsh, when they see that name again? Are they thinking, oh, she really wants this? What?
I think what it is that one of the most powerful things that you, as Wendy was just saying, the most powerful assets that you can have when you're running for office is name recognition.
Okay. And money in the bank.
It really matters. Mm-hmm. It really matters to if you run and you run a good race and you have a good reputation coming out of that race, don't walk away. Come back and use that asset that you have built from that first campaign. But I also want to say that one of the things that we found, and this really builds on what Wendy was saying, when we looked at the Virginia races, you know, we were really skeptical about the numbers because we saw a huge increase in the number of women who were running for the legislature in Virginia in this last cycle. But and it was very heavily on the Democratic side. And I will say all of this increase that we're seeing is all happening on the Democratic side.
And I want to talk about that, too, but go ahead.
But what we saw was the vast majority of those women who were running as challengers. And normally we would say, and we were always, you know, the conventional wisdom is that challengers win 90%+ of the time. Incumbents win 90%+ of the time.
Wait a minute.
Challengers, that is the uphill battle. You know, you do not want to be running for those seats. But what we saw at the end of the day was that 30% of those challengers won their elections. So these women really defied conventional wisdom, and it feels like the conventional wisdom that we all have been following for so many years is a little bit out the window. Well, and it's what sort of, I think, presents a bit of a challenge as we look at all the women who are running in 2018. We can't just say, oh, well, those women are running as challengers. They're not going to make it. You know, maybe we've got to throw a little of that out, defy a little of that conventional wisdom and say run for some of those seats that seem a little unattainable.
Well, again, it's that other effect of Donald Trump, isn't it? That outlier.
Yes. He defied conventional
wisdom. Yeah.
Absolutely. For years, I've lectured and trained to say, no, don't challenge an incumbent. Look for an open seat.
Yeah,
read
right.
the newspaper. Wait for the death, whatever it is.
Right.
And then comes along, you know, this election cycle and it blows everything out of the water. You know, I am so energized and optimistic about this election cycle and what we've learned from it. But I also will say that, and you know, as a researcher, we've got to look at a couple of these before we completely throw away, you know, kind of what we've learned. Because with Virginia, and I say all eyes on Virginia, was a remarkable story.
Tell us about really Virginia. What happened there?
Story. So again, as Debbie alluded to, we're really talking about politics on the Democratic side. And one of the things we know is that women in general, minorities in general, have done better with the Democratic Party. Women are struggling, quite frankly, within the Republican Party in terms of moving through the party as moderates. And there's a host of reasons why those difficulties exist. So Democrats have done, you know, traditionally better. So in talking about just that side, Virginia was the perfect storm, right? So you have this very charismatic gubernatorial candidate on the Democrat side. But one of the things we haven't talked a lot about, and I've actually been quite frustrated with the headlines, we've not kind of talked about the full recipe to what was happening and what was in the mix in Virginia. You also had an African-American man who is running, and I said he is the closest thing to a charismatic Barack Obama. Duke, educated, Columbia educated.
First-time candidate, too, right?
First-time candidate running. And that actually brought a lot of people out to the polls who may not have been energized in the same ways. And in particular, one of the things that we have to note in the Virginia story is that, yes, women were out and vocal, but if we only tell the story from the point of view of women, we're missing just women.
Yeah.
We're missing the story because African-American women were rallying behind this young, vibrant, charismatic African-American man running for a lieutenant governor. And we can't dismiss the power that that had in terms of pulling people up and down the ticket into a high profile.
Because they were turning out at the polls.
They were mobilized.
Right.
Women were on the ground.
They were inspired.
They were inspired. They were organized. They were motivated. They were running complex on-the-ground strategy campaigns to move people. They were calling from Florida. They were calling from Ohio. They were calling from all over the country to influence Virginia voters.
Okay.
So when those people turned out, they also brought with them this idea of electing outsiders. So you have two Latinas who are serving in the Virginia state legislature, right? Who will be coming into the Virginia state legislature.
Right.
So these are like record breakthroughs that we can't dismiss the power of a really strong ground game and mobilizing a new part of the electorate that we don't typically think about in very critical ways.
Before we take a break, I just want to say Virginia elected its first Latina members, its first Asian American woman delegate, and its first openly lesbian member to its General Assembly. My guest, you just heard from Wendy Smooth. She's a political scientist at Ohio State University. She teaches in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department there. Also, Debbie Walsh, director at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. Coming up, we're going to hear from a local woman who has delved into politics and is working to get more women involved. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about women in politics. Once a male-only denizen, women have breached the divide. But in 2017, they ran in record numbers for everything from small-town councils to Congress. Some were negatively motivated by Trump's rise to power. Others were inspired by his success at the polls. He was an outsider with very few credentials when it came to politics, and he won. We're talking about what has changed and what that holds for the future. Still with us by phone is director at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, Debbie Walsh. Also with us, OSU political scientist in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department, Wendy Smooth. And joining us now is Upper Arlington City Council President and Mayor Debbie Johnson, who will be speaking at an upcoming Ready to Run Ohio event. Ready to Run is the nonpartisan campaign training program to encourage and train women to run for elective office. Welcome, Debbie Johnson.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
I wanted to talk about money right now and on a couple of levels, the issue of fundraising and also of donating money. What, Debbie Johnson, does that have to do with Ready to Run? Is that a topic?
Absolutely. Fundraising is definitely one of the breakout topics, and it's, you know, essential to run a campaign. I often tell women, you know, when you are supporting or advocating for other women, make sure you give your time, talent, and your treasure. The treasure is very important because it does take money to run campaigns. And without that, you know, you're behind.
So, you know, what do we know, Debbie Walsh, about women's willingness to donate money to campaigns? It's different than men.
Yeah, you know, we find that women are terrific philanthropic givers, but they are less inclined to give politically. And I think in some ways it may be the same challenge that we have when we talk about getting women to run for office, that they don't necessarily see government and politics as the place to fix the problems that they see in the world. And so rather than give to people in who are running for office, they give to nonprofit organizations. Ann Richards, who is the late and former governor of Texas, used to do a wonderful thing when she would go out and do fundraisers for women candidates. She would look at the women in the audience and say, I want you to give to this woman who's running for office, and I want you to not to just write your $10 check or your $25 check. I want you to think about how much you spent on the outfit you're wearing today.
That's right.
And
I
you
that.
Have to include the shoes. and that was what women need to give to other women who are running for office.
It's
really important.
Yeah. I mean, when you put it in those terms, and I remember that so well, she was funny that way. But Debbie Johnson, it is about values.
It is, yes, absolutely. And I wanted to, one of the things I want to talk about too is there's a group in from Central Ohio who is motivated by the Women's March. It's called Matriots, and they are a statewide women's PAC, and they are going to advocate and endorse and financially support women. It's barely a year old. They're really just getting off the ground.
Yeah, we were trying to get them someone on, but I think we didn't achieve that this time. But Yeah,
so I have been talking with them as well because I love the idea of advancing women in politics. That's very much what I do. And so absolutely giving to that and encouraging women too. I think, as we all know, we need to be encouraged to run. So, but it is, to go back to your values, it really is, it's your integrity, it's your values of what you bring in.
Right up there with our favorite pair of shoes.
Oh, certainly. But, the other thing that's been really exciting, and I think we learned this through the 2008 Obama campaign and, first campaign from President Obama, is that it doesn't take big checks. Right. You can do a lot with a lot of small checks. And so for some women, particularly communities of color who do have some really interesting histories with philanthropy, but will write smaller checks, but will write lots of smaller checks. And mm-hmm. we saw that the $25 donation can go a long way. Certainly we do need and we want those women who are able to contribute major checks, right? Writing those major checks and writing the shoe check, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we also want to encourage those women who will write the $25 check, who are invested in the candidate in such a way, believing in the candidate in such a way that they will participate at any level. And a lot of those can amount to some very big things. So we want to make sure we're, covering both ends of the spectrum.
You're listening.
And I think that's really important because we know that women tell us, and particularly women of color, that it is harder for them to raise the money, but they do raise it. But it is in those smaller increments, right?
Mm-hmm.
A man
mm-hmm.
may make one phone call and get $1,000, and a woman may have to make 10 or 15 of them to get that same amount of money. But I also don't want to beat up women for not being bigger givers in politics.
Sure. Okay.
Because we know women make less money than men. They have less money saved for retirement. They are more economically vulnerable than men. So I want to echo Wendy's comment about, we need to get that kind of giving, but those small checks matter too.
Is the culture for the women at the top of the food chain, the women who are making the big bucks, is that changing a little too? Because I wonder, in some ways, did they get there where they're going because they didn't get into politics, because they didn't advocate for those kinds of issues, and they kind of play it close to the vest? Debbie Welsh?
I don't know. We're still not seeing the kind of big dollar givers mm-hmm. Among women in the same way that we do among men. But honestly, there are still a lot fewer of those women at the very top
right.
of the food chain, as you
right.
described, than
yeah.
there are men as well. So, I wouldn't want to say, there are just so many women who've made it into the
no.
Fortune 500
no,
CEOs.
There are. Yeah.
That's not the case, right?
Right.
So we're underrepresented all the way around,
right.
And we pay for it all the way around.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about women in politics, why they get into it, why in record-breaking numbers this year, why they haven't in the past, and what organizations, different organizations, nonprofit or nonpartisan organizations are doing to change that dynamic. You're a woman. Are you interested in politics? Are you interested in public office, maybe is the better question. Give us a call if you have any questions about this or any insights. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. I wanted to ask you, Debbie Johnson, your city council president, your mayor, which means you're mayor of Upper Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
What inspired you to get involved in the first place yourself?
I'm the stereotypical I was asked.
Sure.
And,
okay. Yeah.
There was a woman going off council. I had been active volunteering in the community, and had never really thought of it before, but certainly had taken on leadership roles in the community before, and said yes.
You just said yes. I mean, what were your thought? What was your thought process in going into it and deciding, yeah, I want to do this?
Just the love of my community. You know, it's truly things that I can see happening and the goals that we have. I just think living there and being a part of that. I also like being in the know a lot. And,
Well, what about taking that next step to higher office? We were talking about that earlier before you joined us, that, yeah, a lot of women, they can identify with those grassroots issues.
Yes.
That's where they feel like they can have the most impact. But
yeah, I think going forward, I think it gets a little tougher to see, you know, if you have goals, if you have things you'd like to see changed or you know, avenues that you want to go down. I think it's tougher at a higher level, you know, whether it be countywide or at the state house or even in Congress, things take longer to get done. And I think to some women, because we're so goal oriented, mm-hmm. I think that's not quite as appealing to some of them.
Mm-hmm. Bernadette in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Bernadette.
Good morning. My question is, how do you know after you support a candidate that is aligned with your beliefs that once they get into office, because of the amount of money they have to continue to raise for campaigns, that they won't buckle up or make promises to big business that go against what the common person needs.
So, Bernadette, you're expressing maybe another reason why women are less interested in donating to political campaigns. Debbie Walsh?
Well, I think you need to hold the people who you support and who you help elect accountable when they're in office, mm-hmm. and they need to keep hearing from you. So, you know, we think about people writing letters to people when they are disliking them, but you also need to write them and let them know that when they're doing things you are supportive of, so that they know that people are out there and they're paying attention. And I think that's probably one of the best things you can do, is to try to keep holding those people that you help elect accountable by letting them hear from you once they are in office.
I totally agree, Debbie. One of the things that we're going to talk about at our symposium here at OSU later this week on Thursday and Friday is, how do you keep communities mobilized in the interim? The only way that communities can continue to receive policy attention from their elected officials is to have a presence. And to have a presence means doing the letter writing. It means calling in and shooting the email. It's bringing things to the attention of Debbie and others to say, hey, we're concerned about this issue. And we have 25 people who are ready to talk to you about those issues.
Yeah.
Our leaders listen to that. So we can't simply vote and then walk away and say, okay, we're going to leave it to now the elected officials to handle that. We've got to remain engaged. And so we'll be talking about how communities remain engaged after they've been highly mobilized. The political parties are really great at mobilizing communities to come out to vote during an important election cycle, but they're not the ones who are going to then say, we'd like you to keep meeting and talking about the issues. Those are the kinds of things that we need to do. Our Kerwin Institute here on campus has done an incredible report about civic engagement, particularly for low-income communities in terms of thinking about communities of color. And we'll have someone from Kerwin talking with us about those principles of civic engagement.
And I think this is a little of what President Obama talked about in his farewell speech, right? He talked about the fact that politics doesn't happen every 4 years. It doesn't happen every 2 years. It happens every day. And that people need to now think about being engaged all the time. You know, it's not just for the election. It's for in between the elections. And it's not just for presidential elections or even congressional elections. It's for all elections. And that's the level of engagement that we need to all have. We need to be that attentive. We have to be.
What I heard from the caller was a lack of trust. And I think
there was some skepticism in her voice, wasn't there, Bernadette?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, as elected officials, you know, again, it goes back to that our values and our integrity. You know, are we doing what we say we're doing? And I think it is up to the people that we represent to hold us accountable. And, you know, I really think it's that lack of trust right there. That's I heard it loud and clear.
Debbie Walsh, before I let you go, I wanted to talk about the Democrat-Republican divide among women. Let's see. There are 78 women Democrats and 27 women Republicans in the U.S. Congress. That's a Congress that is dominated by Republicans. So they're technically, statistically, considering women are 52% of the population, right? There should be more Republican women
if
you look at.
Yeah.
What's the deal? What is it? Because women tend to be more moderate and it's in the swinging. So, right?
In general, it's a complicated
sure.
issue. Among the Democrats in Congress, almost a third of the Democrats who currently serve in Congress are women, and only about 9 or 10% of the Republicans serving in Congress are women. I mean, women are disproportionately registered as Democrats. If you look overall at women, Wendy and I can talk a long time about the variation among women and where they fall out, but overall women are more likely to be Democrats and identify that way. But the Democratic Party, you know, the philosophy of the Democratic Party is a philosophy that is more supportive of the social safety net. And we know that women are, as I said earlier, women are make less money. They have less money saved for retirement. They are more economically insecure. They see themselves as needing and probably will need and take advantage of the social safety net that is out there that the Democratic Party is more supportive of. So that all contributes to that more likelihood of them identifying as Democrats. But we also know that there's more infrastructure on the Democratic side to support women candidates, organizations like an Emily's List. You know, there are PACs out there for women on the Republican side, but nothing of the size of Emily's List. There is a new PAC that is formed that I think Wendy has been involved with called Higher Heights, which is for black women who are aspiring to run for office.
Sure.
There are a number of other PACs on the Democratic side, simply not that same kind of money and organization. And in addition, there's the philosophy within the Republican Party that does not sort of identify with what we would call identity politics, right? Which makes it hard for them to go out and recruit and say, we need more women. It's important to have more women because they're saying, well, these identities, whether it's race or gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, these aren't important, right? We don't need to look at those things. But on the Democratic side, yes, that is a core part of the Democratic Party. So all of this together has made it more complicated. And then I think you have the added issue, which is that the Republican women who were in office tended to be more moderate, and those kinds of women can no longer make it through Republican primaries. If you are at all considered someone who is pro-choice, you have a very tough time making it through a Republican primary. You may be the best candidate for the general election, but you may have a really tough time in a primary where the most extreme, the most conservative voters are coming out.
I agree, Debbie. You've hit on so many of the topics that I would echo. And in fact, I'll say that we have Glenda Carr, who's one of the co-founders of the group Higher Heights that Debbie mentioned, will be joining us this week. But also, as much as we want to talk about the issues around identity politics that the Democratic Party tends to talk more about and attract more women, talking about the social safety net, I am now more convinced than ever that we are now looking at some really serious structural barriers to women seeking political office, particularly moderate Republican women, as Debbie was saying. But I'd go a step further and really touch what is happening right now in Ohio as we're thinking about how we do redistricting. This absolutely matters for women and other outsiders to have an opportunity to serve in political office.
Because not only do you have the beat the incumbent problem, but beat the numbers when it comes to how how the district's drawn.
So I know I can make people roll their eyes and go to sleep, but I can make gerrymandering a really hot and interesting issue
good
to talk
you,
about.
And
we're actually going to kick off the symposium on Thursday with a great conversation around the effects of gerrymandering, the effects of redistricting, voter ID, limitations on early voting. These are all things that have touched Ohioans in a very direct way. And it's increasing the polarization that we see in the state legislature and in Congress. We simply can't get new voices to the table if we're structuring the table in such a way that preclude these groups.
Debbie Walsh, I have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
I want to thank you, and I want to just put in a plug for Ready to Run Ohio and
yes.
thank Debbie for participating.
Yes.
It's on December 7th, mm-hmm. it's with the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. They're a wonderful partner, and that kind of training is so important. So I hope lots of women who are out there who are thinking about running will participate.
Thanks, Debbie Walsh. She's director at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about women in politics and women who decide to run for public office. Still with us, political scientist in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department at Ohio State University, Wendy Smooth. Also, Upper Arlington City Council President and Mayor Debbie Johnson. Joining us now, attorney and a member-elect of the Worthington City Council, Beth Kowalczyk. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you, Ann.
You join the Worthington City Council in January as the fourth female to ever serve on that city council. That sort of surprised me when I read that, you know, when you were elected and I read that so few have served. What inspired you to run?
Well, I think it was like what had been talked about before. I'm one of those women that the 2016 elections affected me quite a bit. I was very frustrated at the outcome and frustrated at what was happening. I was involved with a lot of local groups, protesting, writing postcards, and that just wasn't enough for me. I've been involved in public policy for a long time in my career, and so I felt like there was more that I could offer and more that I could do and that we needed to do more. And it's about being the change that you wish to see.
Were you asked to run?
I was not. So, no, I was looking for an opportunity. It's something that I thought about doing and was waiting to see if there was some opportunity that might occur. And I heard they were looking for more women for Worthington City Council.
Yeah. Starting kind of not at the bottom, but Worthington City Council's something, but just a fourth ever is surprising, Wendy Smooth?
It is surprising, but not so much. The one thing I would say, as you're assuming your office, one of the things that's a funny little tidbit that the research teaches us is that the more women you have, whether you are all in agreement or not, even where you sit in the room matters for the amplification of your
How
voice.
So?
Well, we had a funny little set of research articles in Political Science some time ago, led by a researcher by the name of Lynn Kathleen. And Lynn found that where you sit in the room actually matters for how you're heard. And we've actually, a Washington Post article talked a little bit about, a recent Washington Post article even talked about the ways in which women's ideas in a meeting can totally disappear until one of their male colleagues lifts it up. Mm-hmm. So there are all these strategies that I would love to share with this group of Power Four so that you're actual ideas are heard and are amplified. Something so simple for women out there in any meeting is just to say,
Just as Debbie said, or as Debbie said 5 minutes ago, Mark, I'm so glad that you picked up on Debbie's point. Let's take up Debbie's point. And then we reclaim, right?
It's women's the little things then is what you're saying, you know. And Debbie Johnson, you were talking about just about women sitting up and speaking into the mic.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. When I coach women, you know, on the dais, it is sit up. Arch your back, lean forward, lean in, because we tend to be shorter than some of our male counterparts. And it is a perception as to how we look. And I always joke with them. I go, take your Advil and arch your back. I mean, it's you know.
It's actually good for your spine.
It's very good for your spine. But I've had that. I was joking, I'm laughing at what you're saying is that, yeah, I've said something and it's gone down the line and it's become, you know, it somebody else's idea.
Yeah.
And I'm sure. Sitting there. And at that point, do you speak up or do you not? You know, how is that? How is that entailed? And that's something I think that Beth is going to have to learn. And there's the right time to do that and say, wait, that was my idea. I brought this up in a better way than I just said it. But,
sure.
But
well, that's
you know,
what it always feels like. It's like, wait. Beth Kowalczyk, so you won.
Yes.
And how are you preparing to take office now and to lead?
Well, I'm meeting with council members. I've been attending council meetings throughout the summer to find out what the issues are, and they're finalizing the budget, so I'm becoming familiar with the budget, going to the various commissions and boards to find out the issues that they're working on, and we're going to have a retreat, and so I'm preparing my list of long-term goals, short-term goals, and things that I'd like to see happen.
Was there a particular policy that interested you?
Well, it's really interesting. One of the things that I focused on turned out to be what I work on in my career, which is working on senior services, senior policy.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that considering the demographics of the country and the state, and Worthington in particular has a very high population of people over 65, and it's going to grow. And just talking about livable communities for all ages and what we can do to adapt as our community ages. And that really resonated with a lot of people, mm-hmm. Looking at places to transition into, first floor, one single floor housing, looking at transportation access, accessible services, safety issues, all sorts of things. The Livable Communities Movement is a national movement. And in fact, today, City of Columbus, their age-friendly initiative, has a press conference going on right now. And so I hope to work with them and see if we can extend what they're doing in the city of Columbus to Worthington. So it was really fortunate that I had an issue that was something people weren't thinking about in terms of city council and what you can do at a local level. And there is a lot that you can do.
You know, your story resonates so much. This summer, we had over 500 women from across Ohio come out for an event called Galvanize Ohio.
I was there.
Oh, great.
It was on my birthday.
What a great way to celebrate your birthday.
That was a true sacrament.
500 women from across the state, some who were at this level of saying, I care. I care about my community. I care about my country. I care about, as Debbie was saying earlier, the environment. And it was so touching to see women who were finding their issue, who were figuring out how to talk about their issue. We had campaign trainers. We had organizations to talk about, you know, just using your voice and how to project and, you know, how to boss up and all of these fabulous conversations. And it's so exciting to see that yield, right? Mm-hmm. And actually right away an immediate change for our local communities.
Beth Kowalczyk, I wanted to ask you just, you know, there was the Galvanize mm-hmm. event, but what about that coalition building? Did that play a role in your election?
As far as working with
other people? Yeah.
Well, on many different levels. I have to give a shout out to Vote Run Lead, which is another organization
yes.
nationally that's supporting candidates. And women candidates, and they're very accessible. They have webinars. That's how I first found out about them. But they presented at Galvanize Ohio. And their main objective is to help women run as they are. So thinking of not changing yourself, not becoming what people see as a politician, but running on your strengths, particularly as a woman. So I found that incredibly valuable. But building coalitions is what I do in my work. I'm an advocate. I advocate for good public policy, and it's essential to build relationships and identify common interests. And so doing that by talking to local leaders and identifying what their interests are was something that I thought was very important. I started that early on, and then also working with the local Democratic Party club and others to really understand what I was getting myself into. And then, which when I started, they told me it was going to be easy. And it was not easy. It was wonderful. It was the best experience. But it was definitely something that I learned along the way. But and then really working with other women who were running for office and who are in office, I talked to Elizabeth Brown,
member of the Columbus City Council.
Right, exactly. Because of I really admire the work that she's been doing on City Council, and she's really a leader. And then talking to the women on Worthington City Council as well to find out what it would take and who I should be talking to and all of that.
Right. I mentor a lot of women and a lot of women who are considering, you know, maybe not next year, but in, you know, this is what I want to do. I do want to run for office at some point in time. And the one thing I do is get involved. So I'm happy to hear that, you know, I talked to so many women who's I want to run for this office next year. And it's like, okay, how involved are you? How well known are you? Did you, you know, have you gotten your name out there? What kind of connections, what kind of networks can you do? And they just go, well, I just want to run.
Yeah.
And so it's great to hear all of it is a lot of work. And Beth, I will tell you, it is much easier to serve than it is to run a campaign.
So
it will be.
You hope
it will be. I guarantee it. But get involved. I mean, that's the one message that I leave with women a lot. Get involved in things. Get involved in a campaign, whether it be a candidate or an issue or something in your community that sparks your attention and gives your passion. I mean, that's really what we do. Well,
you know. And the Ready to Run group is fabulous for helping women to think about their networks in creative ways. Think about, and for all the women who are listening out there and going, you know, I could never do that. Think about how you manage your Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how you are the connector to so many different groups of people. Those are your networks. Think about you're the person who sends out the condolence cards for the community. You're the person who connects local school clubs together. You're managing the soccer team. You're keeping these rosters. All of those are your assets.
Right. And they are skills that can be used.
Absolutely.
And actually at the Ready to Run, we have two tracks. We have the candidate track as well as the advocacy track.
Mm-hmm.
So you may not want to run for office, but you want to be involved in politics or policy or helping, you know, again, just get women elected. And there's that track as well. So it's, you know, giving the women the skills and even the networks that they need.
And helping them recognize the skills that they already possess.
Yes.
Just, Beth, we're just about out of time, but did you think you'd win?
I had no idea. there were 9 candidates for 4 seats. So I thought I had a pretty good chance.
And you came in second.
And I came in second. And the two women came in first, second. So I was very excited. But, you know, there's no polling in local elections.
Right.
And it's really hard to tell. But I knew I was getting positive feedback. People really resonated with my message. And having very little name recognition prior to the campaign, I think I did very well. And I'm
second
very
out
excited.
Of 9. Right.
Yeah.
Beth Kowalczyk, thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy your time on the Worthington City Council.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Beth Kowalczyk, first-time candidate, as we just mentioned, came in second out of 9 for Worthington City Council. She will join that body in January. Also, Debbie Johnson, Upper Arlington City Council President and Mayor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Wendy Smooth, political scientist at Ohio State University, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
I want to say the OSU Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department, where Wendy works, is hosting a two-day symposium this week. To learn more about that, give us check out the link at wosu.org/allsides. It's about the growing diversity in the American electorate. And the John Glenn College of Public Affairs will be hosting its Ready to Run campaign training for women conference in December. For more on that, check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.